Welcome to this 11KBW podcast on CN and GN versus Pool BC, Negligence Liability of Public Authorities by James Gowdy QC. This talk was given at the 11KBW Local Authority Conference on 24th of September 2019 at the Turing Lecture Theatre in London. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
So, good afternoon in a wet London, adjacent to the Jurassic Coast, there is Poole in Dorset, a major port, sailing centre and tourist resort where Tolkien lived during his retirement. More to the point, at all material times a unitary local authority, not, I believe, represented here today. So both a social services authority and a housing authority, amongst numerous other capacities. Of course, in two-tier local government areas, these two functions would be split between county social services and district housing, but not in Poole, both together there. The Poole Borough Council case, a case against a public authority, but a private law cause of action, a claim in tort, alleged negligence, but in the discharge, or not as the case may be, of public functions. Negligence by omission rather than by commission. Not the council itself harming children on this occasion, but rather the council failing to protect children from harm caused by third parties. There were many such cases which were held in abeyance while the Poole case was making its way up the judicial ladder. No liability on the part of the council, eventually says the Supreme Court, in the circumstances of the Poole case. Two questions, whether the council itself was directly negligent, and secondly, whether the council would be vicariously liable for negligence by its employees, shades of the Morrison case to which Tim Payne was referring this morning, in the data breach context. And a third question, whether the employees would be liable for their own negligence. Underlying all these questions, whether a common law duty of care was owed in relation to the manner of discharge of statutory functions, social services functions in this case, but with housing functions also involved. The claim was a common form of negligence claim, a PI claim. Injuries were suffered by children of a family living in the council's area. The council had statutory powers and indeed duties under the 1989 Children Act. The question was whether there was a negligent failure to exercise those functions so as to protect children from harm at the hands of third parties. So what was the claimant's case? If I take the first three bullet points on that page, they alleged, the child claimants and their mother alleged that they were placed by the council in a house on an estate in Poole next to a family who, to the council's knowledge, persistently engaged in antisocial behaviour. The family became the target of harassment and abuse at the hands of the other family. This persisted over a period of several years. There was vandalism of the mother's car. There were attacks on the family home, threats of violence, verbal abuse, and indeed physical assaults, both on the mother and on one of the children. And as a result, the claimants suffered both physical and psychological harm. Now, the council did undoubtedly owe duties to the children. They had identified the children as children in need, a concept, of course, for the purposes of the 1989 Act, and indeed the children had social workers allocated to them by the council. So, 1989 Act functions, and also housing functions in the council's capacity as a local housing authority as well. And in a sense, the housing functions aspect is fundamental to the claimant's case. And once that goes, their case is seriously weakened, because the case can be characterised as being concerned with the duty of care owed by a local housing authority to social housing tenants. But the pleaded case is based on statutory provisions. Section 17 of the 1989 Act, a familiar provision, the provision of services for children in need and their families, in Part 3 of the Act relating to local authority support for children and families, and also in Part 5 of the Act, protection of children, very much in point here, Section 47, the local authority's duty to investigate, which the council indeed did do. However, it was accepted, the second bullet point on this slide, I think, that the 1989 Act did not create a statutory cause of action. So the question was whether local authorities may be liable for breach of a common law duty of care in relation to their performance of their functions under the 1989 Act. So what did the Supreme Court say? There was one judgment from the recently announced next president of the Supreme Court, at least if Scotland remains in the Union, which is perhaps a little more likely after this morning than it may have been before, namely Lord Reid, who did the double act with the judgment this morning with the current president, Baroness Hale. And what the Supreme Court said was that public authorities do not owe a duty of care at common law merely because they have statutory powers or duties, even if, by exercising their statutory functions, they could prevent a person from suffering harm. So far, so good from an authority's standpoint. However, they can come under a common law duty to protect someone from harm in circumstances where the principles applicable to private individuals or bodies would also impose such a duty. In other words, a public authority is not in a better position than a private body, but nor are they in a worse position. If one's talking about a claim in negligence, a claim in tort, then the same rules apply regardless of the status and character of the defendant. And the two important examples of where the authority can come under the common law duty are, first of all, rather obviously, if it has created the source of danger, if it has itself created the source of danger, or secondly, the one with which the Poole case really was concerned, if it has assumed a responsibility to protect the claimant from harm, even then may not always be liable, but there is the potential for liability where there has been an assumption of responsibility. So what it comes down to is that there can be liability, and in that context, assumption of responsibility is an important concept. As I've said, the present case was not one where the council was alleged to have harmed the claimants. It had not done so. The allegation against it was of failure to protect them from harm by others. The claimant said, well, the council had assumed a responsibility towards them to take reasonable care in investigating and monitoring their position, though it had done both those things. The fact is that that wasn't enough actually to protect them. And it was said that if sufficient care had been taken in those respects, the council would have exercised its powers under the 1989 Act to remove the claimants from their home into at least temporary care. Well, you can no doubt see where that is leading. It's suggesting that there was a breach of the duty of care by the council doing something which it was very far from obvious it would have been appropriate or even lawful for the council to have done. And the Supreme Court said that the council's positive conduct in both investigating and monitoring the claimant's position did not involve the provision of a service to them on which they or their mother could be expected to rely. In other words, it could not be said that the claimants and their mother had entrusted their safety to the council, or, going to the point, that the council had accepted that responsibility. Nor had the council, in fact, taken the children into care, in which case, of course, it would have assumed responsibility for their welfare, and therefore the council did not accept assume a responsibility towards them. And obviously, one queries whether the council could realistically have succeeded in protecting the children unless it had taken the children into care, if it could have done so, or else had moved one or other or both of the families, if it could have done so, as a housing authority. Now, there was an alternative case for the claimants, namely that the council was vicariously liable for negligence by its social workers. And obviously the social workers were under a duty, a contractual duty, to the council to exercise proper professional skill and care. The question was whether, in addition, they also owed a similar duty to the claimants and under the law of tort. And that depended on whether the social workers assumed a responsibility towards the claimants to perform their functions with reasonable care. And a defendant may assume responsibility where some task or the provision of some service for the claimant is undertaken. In that case, reasonable care will need to be exercised in the discharge of that. There may be an express undertaking. It can fairly readily be implied. But in the circumstances of this case, the particulars of claim did not set out any basis on which an assumption of a responsibility might be established at trial, because this was all about strikeout. And any uncertainty as to whether the case was one which could be properly struck out was eliminated by the further difficulties that arose in relation to the claimant's case, because the claimant's case was that the council had breached its duty of care by failing to move the claimants from their home into at least temporary care. But in order to obtain, that is distinct from the family being moved as an exercise of housing powers, but the family continuing to have their tenancy cheek by jowl with the badly behaved family, with the suggestion being that the children could be moved into care, albeit perhaps only temporary care. But, of course, in order to obtain a care order under the relevant statutory provisions relating to care orders, it would have been necessary to establish that the claimants were suffering or were likely to suffer significant harm which was attributable to a lack or likely lack of reasonable parental care. But the harm suffered by the claimants was attributable to the conduct of the neighbouring family rather than any lack of reasonable parental care. Indeed, the mother, like the children, was a victim of the conduct of the neighbouring family. So, quite simply, there were no grounds for removing the children from their mother. And that really was fatal to the claimant's case. That was a fundamental point. So the council was successful in the pool case in a strikeout, and authorities generally should be relieved that an additional impact on their insurance premiums has been averted. In the Morrison case on vicarious liability, the judges in the Court of Appeal thought that it was all right for Morrisons to be liable because they could insure. That, of course, begs the question of whether you can get the insurance, and there's no question at all but that the premiums would be jacked up and so forth. So there are obviously implications there, but the increase in your premiums that you would have had if Poole had lost the case are at least averted. But, and an important but, authorities should not be complacent, because the Supreme Court decision is emphatically not an acceptance of any public policy defence. On the contrary, that is decisively rejected. So that is now dead and buried, any question of that. The Supreme Court is clear that public bodies owe the same duties as private bodies, no less and no more. And whether a duty of care is owed is evidence and fact sensitive. Whether there will be an assumption of responsibility and reliance upon that will be evidence and fact sensitive. In particular, there is likely to be an assumption of responsibility if the harm to children of which the authority is or should be aware is by parents or by other family members, not, as in the Poole case, from an entirely separate household. And also bear in mind there may be liability if the authority creates a source of danger. However, the basic point from the Poole case is that it is the traditional tortious principles that apply to a private law claim in tort. Duty of care, causation, foreseeability, etc., issues that will not often be determinable on a strikeout. And claimants and their lawyers will no doubt be looking to see whether there are any other claims that they can pursue, notably perhaps, without putting ideas into anyone's mind, human rights claims. So there's a lot of space to continue to watch on the particular area of potential liability in the Poole case. But of course, local authority liability can and does arise in many other contexts. Obviously, the data breach situation, as Tim Payne was explaining, is one which, albeit having arisen with a private employer, could arise with any public authority. Obviously, if one has too exclusive a financial allocation to what one might call the touchy-feely obligations in the social services and educational context, and the potholes all go unmended for lack of resources, then that will give rise to liabilities, qua highway authority and so forth. So there are the usual balances to be struck. As time permits, a bonus, briefly one other recent liability case in a different legislative context, but again involving council housing tenants. This is Rogerson and Bolsover District Council. The reference is 2019 EWCA Civ 226. There the appellant was the tenant of the appellant to the Court of Appeal was the tenant of a council house. She suffered injury as a result of an accident. The issue was whether the council could be liable under the Defective Premises Act. And the relevant defect would have been discovered if the council had implemented a system of regular inspection. Did the council's landlord therefore have a duty to inspect? did, given Section 4 of the 1972 Act, the landlord take such care as reasonable in all the circs to ensure that all persons who might reasonably be affected by defects in the state of the premises are reasonably safe from damage which could be caused by a relevant defect or injury, a fact-specific question to be answered in the context of the circumstances of the particular case, the familiar mantra. But the question was whether the Act required a landlord to implement a system of inspection, and the Court of Appeal said that there was not a general duty to implement a system of regular inspection in order to satisfy that particular legislative provision. In each case, it's a question of fact, one aspect of that being the knowledge of the landlord as to the likely or known risks or problems in the property. In this particular case, inspections were carried out, and therefore the question was whether reasonable care was taken in carrying out the inspections, and whether the defect which resulted in the appellant's accident and injury was or should have been discovered as a result of inspection. And as a warning to authorities, Lady Justice Nicola Davis said, the purpose of Section 4 is to ensure that the landlord is unable to avoid liability to those to whom the duty is owed to maintain the premises free from any relevant defect. So a rather a mixed message there. So again, tortious principles, reasonable care in the circumstance of the particular case, and so forth. But as the Supreme Court decision in the Poole case confirms, in the private law of negligence, the antecedent question is whether there is a duty of care, and if so, the extent of that duty. Only once that question is answered can the question of whether there is a breach of duty be answered. On public law duties, of course, we've had this very morning the unanimous 11-judge English, Scottish, Welsh and Northern Ireland Supreme Court decision about the justiciability and lawfulness or otherwise of prerogative decisions, the reasoning in which merits close attention over some 26 pages. Quite an impressive piece of work to get out following a hearing that concluded only last Thursday afternoon. I'm sure none of the judges wrote the judgment before the hearing even started. And concluding in declaring that the prorogation of Parliament is null, void, and of no effect. And indeed, no doubt you've all caught up on the consequential news, which is that both Houses of Parliament will be resuming their business tomorrow, Wednesday. So that's where we are on that. In terms of wider impact, frustrating the carrying out of constitutional functions, in this case the constitutional functions of Parliament, without any reasonable justification is unlawful. That's the ratio. And a warning to all respondents to judicial review, if you do not put in evidence of justification, you are highly liable to come unstuck. In this case, evidence of justification of a prorogation of Parliament for as long as 5 weeks at a sensitive time. Obviously, however, one is not going to be impelled by what I've just said to put in evidence of justification when it would simply underline the fact that there was no conceivable justification. And if you have a former Prime Minister giving evidence against you, indeed from your own party, that doesn't bode too well either. But that's a fate that local authorities are not so likely to encounter. So you will knock me down with a feather if you come along to me with a judicial review case against you and says the primary witness for the claimant is a former Prime Minister. Not too much, I think, in terms of resisting that. And I can't forbear to mention that I finished within my time therefore have left a little time at least for questions, especially to Rupert and Joe, but also if you like to me.
Thank you for listening. For more details, please visit 11kbw.com.